very interesting opening to a very, very interesting parsha. Parsha Shoftim is the Torah's opportunity to describe a moral and just, a legally robust society built upon a rigorous and efficient judicial system, police force, political system. Obviously, in our day, each of those branches of government have separate arms and separate divisions. In the days of Chazal, in the Torah's view, sometimes emerged. Interestingly enough, a very famous dichotomy, which Shoftim presents between the Sanhedrin and their efforts and interest in applying and enforcing halacha, as we know it, the Shulchan Aruch. Obviously, before the Shulchan Aruch was written, halacha was much more amorphous, but their role, the Sanhedrin, as the central authority, and sometimes from our perch, we view the Sanhedrin merely as a legal arm, but in the days of Chazal, before Torah was committed to text, and in those days, the Sanhedrin functioned as the supreme authority of Torah Shebaal Peh, not just of ruling between Reuven and Shimon, who have a debate, but of actually shaping the evolution of Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is a dynamic, evolving force. It's driven by the mind of man. And this was the central place in which people came to discuss Torah, to debate Torah. So Sanhedrin was the Amud HaOrah, as the Rambam says, the central pivot of Torah Shebaal Peh. Yet Shoftim also describes the Melech. And the Melech also has a role in society. And at least the way the Ran, in a very famous expose, describes it, the role of the Melech was to step in areas in which halacha had loopholes and human beings would suffer or society at large would suffer. So, for example, as we would say, a person who was like O.J. Simpson, who basically many people thought was guilty, or let's say everyone thought was guilty, but based on the legal system, there were loopholes and that person couldn't be convicted. So even in halacha, there are loopholes. If, let's say, some of the witnesses have been compromised or other types of loopholes, and every system has loopholes. Every system has to have general parameters, and if those parameters aren't met, the case fails. So in this case, the melech could step in and actually execute or administer capital punishment or corporeal punishment. So the melech had his own set of laws that were intended not for personal benefit, but for public welfare. The Melech can, of course, unilaterally excommunicate or condemn people's possessions if the public good demands it. Of course, when we talk about a Melech and a king, we get the shivers, because for thousands of years, and it still goes on, totalitarian dictators, monarchs, abused human rights. And in the Jewish perspective, of course, a Melech isn't an abuser. A Melech is merely an agent. Parsha Shoftim describes the extra Sefer Torah, which a Melech must write and carry with him wherever he goes, unlike every Jew who just has to write one Sefer Torah and can leave that Sefer Torah in their closet. The king has to write a second Sefer Torah, which he carries, in order to check against arrogance, in order to prevent abuse. So it's a very interesting Parsha, and it describes the type of society we're meant to construct, something which we stopped thinking about for many, many years in Chutz Laaretz, where we really weren't entrusted with structuring a society. Our world was very much collapsed into the micro sense of our own community, our own Torah, our own Beis Medrash, our own shul, our own mikvah, our own public needs. But the sense of an overarching question, what type of society does the Torah desire? How do we implement HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will on a grand social, political, judicial scale? It's very much the topic of Shoftim in Devarim as they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael and build that society. And the role of the Melech is an interesting one, and unfortunately, even though we do have halacha, we don't have halachic enforcers. It's pretty much people who submit to the halachic system, but we certainly don't have that secondary, parallel, complementary track of Melech that is so vital in correcting halachic aberrances and halachic vacuums. And so much of our problems today is that we don't have halachic enforcement, we don't have alternate routes, even something as painful as the Iguna system, that women are trapped in marriages with two husbands who refuse to release them. And it's really, in the modern context, one of the worst crimes a person can commit. Obviously, each case is different, and sometimes it's not as simple as it seems, but from the husband's perspective, the empowerment which the Torah gave him to create and to dismantle marriages is not something that should be abused or should be used as leverage or manipulative. Chalila v'chassid, any time a person has power, that should lead to manipulation at any level, whether it's moral authority, whether it's family authority. Power is meant to serve, meant to be empowered so that you can provide services. And when power is used to abuse others, or even to not abuse them in the stark exploitative sense, but just to make them feel less and inferior and to lord, it's now 1 week into Elul. We've all been blowing the shofar and reciting L'David Hashem Ori V'Yishi, and Emirat Hashem. In another 3 weeks will be Rosh Hashanah, approximately another month, approximately Yom Kippur. And one of the alchets we recite on Yom Kippur, which sometimes we blow by, sometimes we don't pay sufficient attention to, alchet shechatanu lefanecha b'chosek yad. Chosek yad means the abuse of authority. And that abuse can be very extreme and coarse and gross, or it can be very subtle. But anytime we use our authority, anytime we enjoy the imposition of our authority on others, anytime we impose it as an ends unto itself rather than a means to a larger ends, that's a violation of Chosek Yad. So this is Parsha Shoftim, but in the first Pasuk, it's a very interesting phrase which means one thing, but which Chazal shift to mean another thing. The final phrase of the first Pasuk, Vishaftu Esa'am Mishpat Tzedek, they should adjudicate, they should judge the people correct, authentic, true justice. And certainly juxtaposed to the next pasuk, not to corrupt the verdict, not to favor the poor, or to favor the rich, not to accept bribes. A famous, famous pasuk. You can't get any more famous pasuk than the fact that a bribe can blind even the wise people. Money corrupts, power corrupts. So in that context, it obviously means you should judge the people correct, accurate, authentic, righteous, honest judgment. You shouldn't take bribes, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't pay people off, etc. But Chazal took this phrase, v'shaftu esa'am mishpat tzedek, to mean something entirely different, and in many ways something antithetical and contrary to the simple reading that you should make sure that you judge people accurately, correctly, precisely. Chazal took this as a general demand, expectation, as to the way we view not litigants in particular, but Am Yisrael, Jews. Do we give people the benefit of the doubt? Do we see people in favorable light? Do we highlight the positive? Which is generally true in life. It's generally better to be a lover of human beings rather than a misanthrope. It's better to highlight the positive rather than to be a cynic. It's better to see people's positive traits rather than constantly harping and amplifying the negative. But when it comes to our relationship with our own people, with Jews, v'shaftu es ha'am, in that case, mishpat tzedek, not accurate or honest judgment, but if anything, a judgment which is loving, which is favorable, which is embracing and accepting, and in short, as we would call it in our context, Ahavas Yisrael. To be able to generate the love and sustain love for Jews, and not just the Jews in our orbit closest to us, but those who are different from us, sometimes vastly different from us. One of the great challenges in our world is to feel such alienation from Jews who are no longer deeply religious, and those phrases are obviously very, very loaded phrases, because there are many levels of non-religious Jews, and each of them strike us and affect us in different ways. Living in Israel, we're exposed to a very large swath of the population known as Masorati, many of them being Sephardic Jews, though not all of them. And certainly a Masorati Jew, loosely translated as traditional, strikes you as very different than, let's say, a Reform or a Conservative Jew would in the United States. And each have their own, you know, strengths and weaknesses. But you certainly sense in a Masorati Jew the commitment to the basic framework of theology, some interest in, a loose interest in mitzvahs, but an enthusiasm about religion, not necessarily the ability to translate that enthusiasm into detail, into obedience, into adherence. But being, it's almost as if a person could go to sleep in 1800 and wake up in the year 2012. When he went to sleep, the world was religious. The Jewish world was religious, and all of a sudden in 2012, 200 years later, so many millions, the vast majority of Jews aren't religious. And It should cause alienation. It should cause, not alienation, but Ohevei Hashem Sinu Ra, the first step of Avas Hashem, is being able to not allow pluralism, tolerance, and acceptance to blur values and a sense of right and wrong, and to know that these types of behaviors and lifestyles are deviant, are aberrant, are a betrayal of everything that we've stood for and lived for thousands of years, and died for thousands of years. And yet, to be able to feel that sense of fraternity and brotherhood and common destiny, and in many ways, that's really the, again, this is a statement being offered from a Dati Lumi perspective. I'm sure the Haredi person would be asked, he'd have a different opinion about this, but certainly from my perspective, one of the reasons that I feel comfortable living in the Dati Lumi community, with all of its limitations, and honesty demands that you recognize the limitations in any community, is the sense of fraternity that this community searches for, even with secular Jews, and particularly with secular Zionists, that we share a common fate, share a common destiny, we're partners in an enterprise, we are co-combatants, we fight in the same wars, and we live the same experience, and it comes at a very, very high price, very, very high price. Again, from my perspective, the Haredi decision, which is very appealing, has been to a degree, to secede from that society because it's so treif, because the challenges of that culture are so great, and because the culture at so many levels is so vulgar, and because so many are non-believers and atheists, and the danger, cultural influence to our children, to ourselves, is so great that a sense of we don't want much to do with that society. And I understand the trade-off. But what makes, to me, Dati Lumi appealing is, with all the challenges that it entails, and I'm not simplifying those challenges, we're searching, and we don't always find it, and it isn't always reciprocated. But we won't allow ourselves to lose that common bond with Jews, no matter how far they've strayed. And we'll try to highlight the as favorably as we can all the heroic and positive efforts that are being made on behalf of Judaism, if not religion, at least Judaism, the Jewish people, the Jewish state. Now, obviously, it's all one package. If you accept the state as an organ of Jewish redemption and Jewish regeneration and as a divine delivery, then people that live within that state as common citizens, you don't just respect them as you would in any state, in Italy or in Turkey or in Britain, you know, that you have to get along as part of one social cohesive unit, as part of a social contract, but you obviously see them as co-authors of something historical and co-authors and partners of something divine, even if it's subconscious and not aware of it. A Haredi person who doesn't really see the state in those terms, and again, the different levels of Haredism, would have a harder time accepting the commonality, because there's really nothing of importance that we are really common partners in. We live in the same state, obviously, so you have to respect each other's rights, etc. And again, just in the backdrop of what went on this past year, I was approached yesterday by a student in the yeshiva, a Shanala student who's still, you know, showing a little bit of his naivete, and he said to me, he showed me Gemara and Brachos, in which a woman was dressed inappropriately in the days of Chazal, and Avidi Bar Avin, who was in yesterday's daf, ripped her clothing off, and then realized that it was not a Jew, and therefore had to pay her back, and whatever the story was, he said, well, this would be a Haredi approach, right? And I was aghast. You know, 99% of Haredim don't rip clothing off of women, or don't rip clothing off of men, or don't damage other people's property, and they're very respectful. And like every community, there are extremists that, you know, hijack the public agenda and make people believe. In the Dati Lumi community, there are also extremists who burn olive fields and who commit acts of terror against innocent civilians, and even those who are so fierce in their commitment to this land that they can't bear to feel that common bond with secular or leftist Jews in this country who aren't as enthusiastic or zealous about settling the land and the general interests of Eretz Yisrael as we see them. And that's been a real challenge even in my community, to try to protect that sense of Avas Yisrael. So that's really what stems, and again, I'm running out of time a little bit, but it comes from an interesting pasuk in Shoftim, in which a malach appears to, of all people, Gidon. And Gidon was not really one of the more erudite or righteous members of the cast of Shoftim. Those of you who have read Shoftim know that he hung out with people who were less than virtuous, less than educated. Gidom in Harekim used to hang out with people who were, as we would call them, vagabonds, or not vagabonds, but a very, very wild and untamed crew. And the Medrash comments on that pasuk, and it quotes the pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, our Parsha, about Gidon's story in Sefer Shoftim. So it's a very interesting play on the two words. On the one hand, you have to create a society that's realistic about people, and you can't be too glowing and too naive and assuming everyone is great and everyone is virtuous in the strict legal setting. There has to be a sense of Shoftim, of justice, of accuracy, of information, of real-time verdicts. But when we're not judging in the legal setting and we're, so to speak, judging in the national setting, do we always look at people's negatives on a personal level? But that's not really the issue here. It's more, do we look at Am Yisrael, the great, you know, sometimes I wonder if I could go back and meet one person from each century, who would I want to meet if I could go back into a time machine? So one of the hardest centuries to come up with an answer is the 19th century. There's so many great personalities and particularly Torah personalities in the 19th century. It would be impossible. Sometimes you feel like it's easy to pin down the man of the century, the person of the century, the Torah scholar of the century. But someone who I always found intriguing, and we all find intriguing, was Rebbe Yitzchak of Berditchev, the great Hasidic Rebbe, who had such a love for the Jewish people and such an interest in defending them rather than prosecuting them. So many stories, just one, just for those who may be uninitiated and underexposed to Rebbe Yitzchak. He saw a Jew eating on Yom Kippur in the street, and he asked him, well, you know, do you know it's Yom Kippur? Thinking that maybe the Jew just didn't know. That's why he was eating in a public display. And the Jew said, I know it's Yom Kippur. And then he said, well, do you know that, you know, you're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur? Again, thinking naively that the Jew probably, you know, just didn't know. And he said, no, I know it's Asur to eat on Yom Kippur. And he asked him a range of questions, which were based on the assumption that he really didn't know, or he really had the permission to eat because he wasn't feeling well, whatever the story was. Well, not feeling well, but was deathly ill. And at some point, when he ran out of questions, and he recognized this was a person who was making a public mockery of Yom Kippur, publicly disparaging Yom Kippur, he turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and he said, look how great your people are. They refuse to lie, even when it would be embarrassing. And, okay, so that's obviously an extreme, but and what I find so fascinating, especially given my comments before, is that I've met people and I've been inspired by people. And one of the people that I feel gave me the type of message that was very similar to Rebbe Yitzchak was Rav Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, my Rosh Yeshiva, who had that sense of trying to, and obviously Rav Kook, people who have been exposed to Rav Kook, that sense of the common agenda that we share, even with secular and even with atheist Jews. But these are people, Rav Kook and Rav Amital, who lived in the state of Israel and had that organ to create that structural and national cohesion. But Rebbe Yitzchak didn't have that. He lived in Europe, and he lived in the midst of the diaspora after thousands of years of dispersion and lack of social or national cohesion, and he still came up with that sense. Well, the first Rebbe Yitzchak was Gidon. And Gidon, when this Malach comes to him, he begins to complain, how could you take us out of Mitzrayim and still let us, as we would say, twist in the wind? Because Sefer Shoftim is really about twisting in the wind and not moving forward. And most of the Nevi'im in Sefer Shoftim recognize that this pause in national destiny is deserved because the Jewish people were so disloyal and so frustrating and so cowardly. But Gidon is just frustrated. They're your people and you should love them and you should see how great they are and not necessarily point out their negatives. And because of this, Gidon is chosen as one of the great heroes of Sefer Shoftim because of his love for Am Yisrael. So the pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, v'shaftu asam mishpat tzedek, Chazal take it to refer to Gidon. People who are able to get past, Jewish people aren't always easy to love. It's a real challenge. Even when they're religious, they're not easy to love. Some, even when they're not religious, then they should be more challenging to love. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes people feel more attracted to secular Jews because they dress the same way and they see the same movies. And it's really very, very, I mean, you should feel close to every Jew, but you share more with religious Jews than you do with non-religious Jews. But you should embrace all. And this pasuk, v'shavtu asam mishpat tzedek, this pasuk is a hint to a great leader that would one day arise from nowhere, Gidon, who had no classic credentials and CV in terms of his tzidkus, his piety, and his erudition. He would arise from nowhere, Gidon. And it talks about a Hasidic Rebbe who would arise from nowhere in the 19th century, and about a great Jewish leader, Rav Kook, who would arise in the 20th century. And at least from my perspective, the people, maybe those who are listening have met and or have heard stories of Amital Zichrona Levracha, really had that sense of Bitzedek Tishvod Amisecha. Shabbat Shalom.